Welcome to Hub Headlines. Today's program features the best commentary and analysis published in the Hub for April 25th. Up first is Ginny Roth, writing on why leaders who disregard citizen unhappiness would be doing so at their own peril.
Public policy is about imperfect choices, and it can be hard to analyze the impact of those choices on people's lives. Disaggregating the data, controlling for the right variables, knowing the causal direction, or even properly understanding when a given public policy choice might have made a meaningful difference, often many years down the line, can become a fool's errand. Successful public policymakers must have a broader measure in mind when they conceive of how to have a positive impact, and an orientation towards creating the conditions for happiness is the right one. Maybe that seems obvious, but to our current government, it's far from it. Canada's Liberals have undertaken a series of policy blunders, informed by an incoherent mix of blunt economic measures, disordered libertarianism, and trendy academic social policy, each of which has led them off the path of a holistic view of creating the conditions for human flourishing, away from long-term thinking and common sense, and toward a kind of technocratic disengagement from reality. They're far from the only ones. It's a common story for long-serving governments and a warning to aspiring leaders. As Sean Speer and Taylor Jackson note in their recent deep dive, blunt, aggregate economic measures often fail as proxies for the success of a given political program. Canada's GDP and the government's simplistic orientation around increasing it is the obvious example. Other analysts, particularly in the U.S., have pointed to young people's rising incomes to make the argument that young people ought not to be so unhappy. But this simplistic analysis and policy orientation misses regional disparities in personal preferences, rising inflation, and low housing supply. In North America, it fails to account for the difference between income and wealth, as well as the meaning humans derive from owning a home, starting a family, and providing for it. A government looking only at GDP and forgetting about happiness will increase immigration where there aren't enough houses or family doctors, roll out one-size-fits-all childcare to drive more women into the workforce full-time, even if that's not what makes many of them happy, and try to pressure pension plans to invest domestically, even if it flies in the face of their responsibility to Canadian seniors. In sum, economic measures are important data points, but they're weak as singular measures of public policy success. Working back from aggregate data points doesn't work for public policy development, but neither does working forward from public opinion, consumer behavior, or completely disaggregated individual preference. While the Liberals seem comfortable limiting choice to try to increase GDP, they have been intent on taking a hands-off libertarian approach to such serious matters as euthanasia, illicit drug use, and children's mental health. When governments, left and right, lose sight of the goal of long-term happiness, particularly as they grapple with new technologies and the tough question of developing public policies to mitigate their potential harms, they revert to a faulty definition of liberty, one which puts pure individual freedom before human dignity. In Canada, losing the happiness lens has led to a 27-year-old with autism pursuing MAID, the funded legal supply of dangerous drugs to addicts in cities across the country, and an unwillingness to limit teenage access to social media and pornography that we know is causing them greater long-term unhappiness. Finally, and more recently, our government decision-makers and others have been taken with faddish academic theories that, when applied to real-life public policymaking, lead them so far away from enabling long-term happiness that they can't find their way back on a map. Whether it's DEI-driven university research funding creating the conditions for rampant anti-Semitism on campus or foolhardy bail policy leading to the catch and release of repeat violent offenders, senior politicians and public servants in Canada and elsewhere have allowed themselves to be captured by trendy social justice initiatives which seem only to serve the interests of the elites who espouse their philosophical underpinnings. And worse, it is increasingly clear these are actually producing harm, especially for working-class people who feel the full effects of their consequences. In other words, these policies aren't just neutral when it comes to happiness. They're deleterious. It's not easy to aim for happiness. Political leaders need to think of it as a lens and a measurement and work back from first principles, lest they be tempted to appoint a happiness czar or something equally silly, aping the pursuit of happiness instead of creating the conditions for it. But just as the elusiveness of happiness ought not to deter individuals from pursuing it, its intangibility ought not to deter government from trying to create the conditions to enable it. Maybe I'm biased. After all, setting happiness as the barometer for success kind of rigs the game for my preferred approach. Indeed, as I see it, working back from creating the conditions of happiness lends itself well to a traditionally conservative worldview, one which advances a culture of laws, rules, and norms that protect against harm and guard against vice, and which pursues economic policy that creates the conditions for people to find dignifying work, upward mobility, home ownership, and the pride in providing those same things for their families. But that doesn't mean conservatives are immune to looking to the same false gauges Canada's liberals have chosen. It's not at all hard to imagine a future conservative government fixating on one blunt economic measure, defaulting to simplistic libertarianism, or being taken with impractical ideological theories. To avoid this, I think we ought to take a page from leaders past and aim for a kind of ordered liberty if we want to create the conditions for happier citizens. But of course, there may be a better way, and if there is, I would certainly encourage my political opponents to try it. After all, if we want to compare notes, we can always check in on a future World Happiness Report.
That was a commentary by Ginny Roth. She is the National Practice Lead for Government Relations at Crestview Strategy. You can find the full text of her article on our website, thehub.ca. Our second essay is by Daniel Zechfeld, writing on how Canada is failing to safeguard those with mental illness from MAID.
Parliament voted in 2021 to legalize medical assistance in dying, or MAID, for people whose sole underlying condition is mental illness. But after wrestling with the ethical and practical complications of MAID for mental illness, Parliament has delayed the coming into force of that law until 2027. Patients eligible for MAID in Canada are separated into Track 1 and Track 2, which require slightly different processes and safeguards. Track 1 is for those whose natural death is reasonably foreseeable, while Track 2 is for those who have an irremediable medical condition but are not nearing death. MAID deaths overall were relatively equal between men at 51.4% and women at 48.6% in 2022. However, Track 2 MAID in Canada has a significantly skewed gender ratio. In 2022, 59% of those who received Track 2 MAID were women and 41% were men. Why would there be such a disparity? Perhaps because Canada is already euthanizing people with mental illness. Consider euthanasia and assisted suicide, or EAS, in the Netherlands, for comparison. Overall, rates of men and women receiving EAS in the Netherlands in 2022 were nearly equal, at 50.6% male and 49.4% female, which is similar to Canadian rates for MAID overall. When it comes to EAS for psychiatric conditions, however, the rates become drastically unequal. One study found that between 2012 and 2018, 65% of those granted psychiatric EAS in the Netherlands were female and 35% were male. Another study found that women make up between 69 and 77% of all those who request and receive psychiatric EAS in Belgium and the Netherlands. The gender disparity for psychiatric MAID in the few nations where it has been legalized mirrors the ratio of female-male suicide attempts. Although male suicide attempts are lethal at twice the rate of female attempts, women attempt suicide at twice the rate of men. The British Journal of Psychiatry notes that women are less likely than men to cause themselves pain or violence. In China, for example, high female suicide rates into the early 2000s, particularly in rural areas, were attributed to relatively easy access to non-violent means. Another group of researchers concludes that the availability of EAS in the Netherlands may render more effective the wish to die of women whose suffering from mental illness is unbearable. Canada must grapple with this evidence as the legalization of MAID for mental illness looms. But gender disparity in MAID is already a reality in Canada, particularly within Track 2, which lacks effective safeguards to prevent patients with mental illness from using MAID as a means of suicide. Canadians should be raising the alarm that Track 2 may also be simply rendering more effective the wish to die of women whose suffering from mental illness is unbearable. Canada's current MAID law excludes MAID for mental illness as the sole underlying medical condition. But our law does not exclude MAID for mental illness entirely. Even if a MAID request is related to a patient's mental illness, they may still receive MAID provided they have another irremediable condition that causes intolerable physical or psychological suffering. For example, an able-bodied patient who is depressed is not eligible for MAID, but a person with a serious disability caused by a major accident may be, even if they are not nearing natural death. That same patient might ultimately request MAID because of their depression, but be approved because of their disability. In fact, it may be that more patients dying by Track 2 MAID suffer from mental illness. As Dr. Sonu Gaind explained about suicidality, on the face of it, even if you look at what the word means, when somebody wants to die and they're not dying, of course that means that they're suicidal. In Canada, a patient might be offered counseling to help relieve suffering, but there is no requirement to address mental illness prior to providing MAID. The patient must be informed of means available to relieve their suffering, and the patient and medical practitioner must agree that the person has given serious consideration to those means. Even so, it can be challenging to determine what means might relieve one's suffering. In the state of Oregon, by contrast, if one of two physicians assessing a patient believes that judgment may be impaired by a psychiatric or psychological disorder or depression, the physician must refer the patient for counseling and cannot prescribe MAID medication until it is determined the patient's judgment is not impaired. Even this safeguard, however, is complicated by an inevitable element of physician subjectivity in assessing a patient's capacity to choose MAID. One research paper on psychiatric EAS in the Netherlands notes that granting requests appears to involve considerable physician judgment, usually involving multiple physicians who do not always agree, and sometimes without independent psychiatric input. In Canada, while there is a requirement for two physicians or nurse practitioners to approve a request, there is no requirement for a psychiatrist to be involved. Further, if one physician deems a patient ineligible, the patient may look for another doctor who believes otherwise. As a result, patients are currently being approved for MAID due to mental illness. Take, for instance, the story of Donna Duncan. Duncan was in a car accident in 2020, following which she suffered from post-concussion syndrome and various mental health problems. Duncan was approved for MAID by two physicians in October 2021 and euthanized shortly thereafter. Duncan's daughters believed she would have recovered with proper treatment for depression, stating that it took a year to get treatment, but it could only take 4 days to die. In 2022, 23-year-old Keanu Vafayan had reportedly been approved for MAID. His only physical disabilities were diabetes and loss of vision in one eye, but he was also depressed. He was approved for MAID. Vafayan's mother found out about his scheduled MAID death and began posting about the situation on social media, stating the doctor literally has given him the gun to kill himself. Because of Keanu's mother's advocacy, the doctor decided not to go through with providing MAID. The problems with Track 2 MAID continue, including stories of people who access MAID instead of the necessary supports, an issue that the Canadian Human Rights Commissioner recently urged the government to thoroughly examine. Beyond that, Track 2 is providing MAID for those who are not dying, some of whom are suffering from mental illness. Canadian MAID data does not separate mental illness from other MAID requests as the Netherlands does. But the lack of safeguards, stories of Canadians being approved for MAID despite mental illness, and of course the gender disparity in Track 2 MAID, are alarming. At the very least, Track 2 MAID needs more effective safeguards. Rather than consider further expansion of MAID, the federal government ought to focus on resolving existing problems and refuse to provide a fail-proof means of suicide to Canadians who are not dying.
That was a commentary by Daniel Zechveld. He is a policy analyst with the Association for Reformed Political Action. That's it for today's edition of Hub Headlines. We hope you enjoyed the program. To receive all our best commentary and analysis each morning by email, subscribe to the Hub for as little as 25 cents a day. You can do that right now at thehub.ca. Hub Headlines is produced by Alicia Rao. Thanks for listening.